This week on Decentralize, 3D printing, the future of work, Bitcoin core development. Then we talk to Bitcoin expert Andreas Antonopoulos.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm Jazz Ferguson.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralize.
So James, you recently shared an article on 3D printing and its applications to basically, I hate this word, but disrupting the manufacturing industry by decentralizing it, pushing the actual process of manufacturing out to the edges of that network. Give me a little context as to how you came across this and what do you think it means?
Yeah, so it's actually an interview on Econ Talk, the podcast I referenced last week, with Chris Anderson, the former editor of Wired magazine, who actually went on to start a 3D printing company. He's also the originator of sort of the long tail idea with sort of the internet and content distribution, which is very interesting as well. He's definitely been sort of on the forefront of a lot of these ideas, and he wrote a book. I think it's in 2012 called I think it was titled The Maker Movement, actually. And now that term is more widely known. And the reason I'm interested in it for the purposes of this show and just in general is that it's so easy to talk about how decentralization affects things like software, which is you can very, very easily establish a connection, but in really more capitalized activities like manufacturing things, the barrier to decentralization has seemed so high for so long. It's very easy to reproduce a piece of software on your computer at home, low cost, low marginal cost reproduction. It hasn't been that easy to do that with physical things, with the world of atoms, as Peter Thiel would say. But now it's becoming a lot more possible. Now we have things like the MakerBot and other 3D printing models out there, which are making like home manufacturing and customization so much more possible and feasible and like actually increasingly affordable. And I find that really exciting and really interesting with its impacts on how we live our lives, I guess, because we've always had this. Well, not we haven't always, but you know, for the past two centuries, I guess, since first industrial revolution, manufacturing has been a very centralized process. It's whoever has enough capital to afford building a factory, hiring a bunch of workers, and then producing and shipping low cost goods in mass with that kind of scale. Now you have a situation where, and we aren't there yet. We're far from there, but increasingly so. It's affordable and reasonable for you in your own home to download a design from the internet, have it printed, you know, layers of plastic or whatever material your printer uses to produce small implements. So whether you need maybe tool parts or maybe even computer parts, you don't have to go to the store anymore. You don't have to sort of wait on that centralized distribution. You can rely a lot on not only on that sort of decentralized self-making DIY process using, you know, essentially very high technology with 3D printing, as well as another aspect of this, which is very interesting to me as well, which is the sort of open source design sharing that drives a lot of this. Obviously, you need to have the hardware, but you need to also have the quote-unquote software, the design that 3D printers use. That's going to be another interesting aspect of where this goes, how people share designs, how people make them and collaborate on them. That's also going to be a big part of fueling, I think, what this means for decentralization.
Yeah, so the manufacturing thing is very interesting. The entire world changed once we had this model of big factories mass producing things at scale. Things got into people, the common citizens' hands, that previously were only available to, you know, the kings and queens long prior, because they were made by craftsmen and they were just luxury goods. So suddenly, once you had this infrastructure, you could produce goods, mass produce goods, much faster, and they became commoditized basically. So now the average, you know, citizen could go buy, you know, a hammer or a set of pliers or an ice tong, right? And that was actually available. And further on, you look further down the line and you look at the automobile. You know, everyone sort of points to Ford as being the inventor of the automobile, but in fact, that's not true at all. All he did was, you know, invent the manufacturing process. There, automobiles have existed since the late 1800s, and it was just Ford who turned them from a, you know, small hobby thing that only the, you know, the wealthy could afford into something that was widely available to a lot of people. It's 3D printing is really interesting in the sense that it's almost like we're going through another massive revolution, in that we're further breaking down that model and increasing the availability of goods like this by simply allowing someone to purchase a much cheaper device that, I don't know how many of our listeners have seen Star Trek and have seen the replicators in The Next Generation forward, but you literally walk up to a computer and you're like, cup of hot tea, you know, black, and it just makes that for you. Or I would like a game of Monopoly, and it just prints it for you right there on the spot, just materializes it. I think 3D printing is exactly that. I follow a lot of scientific journals and a lot of papers that come across, and it seems like every week there is a new 3D printing method or 3D printing innovation that just blows my mind. I'll give two examples. A few weeks ago, I saw a paper come out that was about doing precision coloring through dipping in liquid, right? So they pre-print this film that sits on top of like a special liquid. Actually, it might just be water for all I know. And you basically take a printed object and you dip it into that 3D printed, or into that that liquid, and it perfectly overlays that pattern or that design on top of the 3D object. And there's all sorts of crazy math behind the scenes that print the film so that the distortion and like the stretching of the film that you're stretching over this thing perfectly match the 3D contours. And that just fascinated me. And then the other was this very recent thing where it is a high speed, like, arbitrary direction printer, and it was stunning just how like accurate and detailed it could get. It just blew my mind. And those are academic prototypes, of course, but then you've got, you know, MakerBot, I think, is just a little over a couple hundred bucks. You've got much more complex machines. 3D printing has only been around for a very short period of time. I mean, a decade or less in the consumer context. And we're already at the point where we can download a design off of a website. We can download a design off of BitTorrent. We can get it from wherever we want and literally pass that downloaded file to our printer, and it prints an object for us. In many cases, those objects can be, you know, simple little models, but we're getting to the point where these objects can be complex things with many moving parts. Mechanical parts. Cody Wilson's Ghost Gunner project comes to mind, where you literally put in a specialized block of aluminum, and out comes a prefabbed, you know, AR-15 upper, right? And that is amazing. That is putting things in the hands of people that previously didn't have access to these types of tools. And it's not a single cost. It's you're now buying something that enables you to produce things almost indefinitely in the future. And this is just going to become more and more accessible. And I do think that this, you know, sort of sets up our next topic well, which is, well, what happens now that we don't have you know, factory workers working in these places? 3D printing is massive, and I'm super excited for it. I think we are getting to this next generation replicator's point.
No, yeah, absolutely. And I think there are three reasons, I guess, before we talk about sort of the jobs idea, which is a big part of how this is disrupting manufacturing. But I think there are three main reasons 3D printing is taking off, and I'd like to see what you think of it. First, I think it's because it's so decentralized. Like you said, with Cody Wilson's Ghost Gunner, anyone can make anything now. Right now, I mean, these devices aren't networked, they aren't registered. You can be making something somewhere without anyone knowing what you're making. And maybe that's a little scary for some people, but it's ultimate decentralization in a lot of ways. And it's not just that, like, it's not just the freedom to create just about anything. I mean, you can create even people are actually working on medical applications for this, 3D printing organs, skin tissue, et cetera. It's really fantastic. Not only do you have that, you also have, for the first time, I think, and actually this is something Chris Anderson pointed out in his interview, we've always had a maker movement. We've always had people tinkering on things in their shops. But the way he expressed it was that, you know, we don't have to invent the wheel anymore because we do have the internet, because we do have the ability to share our designs, share what we're working on, and collaborate. We can actually make new things. We can actually see, hey, this has been made. I'm going to make something else. And that's a huge advancement. I mean, that's another way, you know, similar to how GitHub lets us build on each other's code. This sort of thing will let us build on each other's like actual hardware and real tools. And finally, I think this is a case of one of those 0-to-1 innovations. Like, this is an entirely new category of technology. It's not just like a better kind of software. You know, like we said earlier, I mean, it's an entirely new approach to a whole field, which is just the physical world, I guess. It's I don't know. It's attaching a lot of the digital principles to the physical world, which I think is really cool. And like you were saying earlier, I mean, I think it's really odd how things cycle. And in a lot of ways, with this, we're getting a sort of artisanship for the digital age. Like, we're cycling back in a lot of ways with a lot of technologies to sort of the 19th century, and other writers better than us have made that observation. But like, you know, you have Airbnb where you're staying with strangers, you have 3D printing where people are making homemade things, and very customized things too. That's another thing to look out for. And customization will be increasingly possible. You know, I guess sort of Bitcoin, non-state money. That's also very, very interesting to see how those cycles emerge. But one cycle that's always been around, as you were saying, was this sort of curiosity and concern, mostly concern among a lot of people about tech's impact on people's ability to make a living, people's skills, you know, things like 3D printing ultimately do replace human labor in manufacturing. And that's obviously been a process that's been going on for a long time. And the whole argument over Luddism, you know, versus tech progress, whether tech creates wealth in the long term for society, and even in the medium and short term, that's a fairly settled question, I guess. But maybe a more complex question, which I wanted to get your thoughts on, is sort of how people, as people, adjust to the process of being replaced. Because even when we have a huge increase in productivity and value created through things like, you know, the addition of robots, addition of 3D printers, what have you. Bitcoin, in this case, is disintermediating a lot of banking jobs, I guess. How culturally do we respond? How do we as individuals respond to a really rapidly changing world where we're all pretty much going to be obsolete in 10 years? What do you think, Eric? Softball question for you.
It's a pretty easy answer for me. Everything starts with the individual. And if you take it on as that, and we'll move backwards from that, we'll say, look, adapt or die. The world is going to continuously change. It will always be this way. It will probably even accelerate in terms of the direction, the speed at which it's changing. You have to adapt. And if you're gonna sit back and you're going to stagnate on, you know, be happy with what you know, then you're going to be left behind because the world will change around you. And there are some people that are content with that and some people don't. That's perfectly fine. You can live a long, happy life that way. If you're fortunate enough to live in an environment where you're either A, good enough at your job to survive, something perhaps more generalized taking your place, or B, you're in an industry that is just going to be the last one to be sort of mechanized, if you will. And I don't want to make that bet. I personally, and I think people in the other camp don't want to make that bet because it seems like a losing proposition. You're going to have to learn to adapt if you're going to survive. And the way I see that playing out, sort of from a society perspective, I don't think that, you know, society, we don't need to do anything as a society. Society is an organism that is emergent from our individuality. It's not something that, you know, you can steer in any specific direction. There is going to be camps of people that will be disrupted. They will be angry. They'll be upset. They'll have lost their jobs, and they'll be, you know, sent into poverty. And that's a shame. So the biggest answer that I have to address that is, again, back to us as individuals. The only type of sovereignty that exists is individual sovereignty. Sovereignty over one's own self and one's own actions, period. There is no true sovereignty outside of individuality. The best thing that we can do as sovereign individuals is help educate and inform, spread knowledge to people around us and spread information and spread skills, teach people how to do things, teach people how to code, teach people how to reason around logic and mathematics and to a more direct extent. I always hit on the programming aspect because there will always be some aspect for the foreseeable future of instructing a machine. It's super, super important to not be a slave of the machine. And if you can't instruct the machine on what to do programmatically, then you become an instrument of the machine's will. And furthermore, you become an instrument of the person who programmed the machine. And when machines become sentient, then we have a whole nother rank class of individual that we're going to have to deal with. So I think the best thing that we can do is personally educate and inform ourselves and adapt. And furthermore, if we would like to do societal good, then we need to help educate and inform the people around us.
Well said. I really like that. And this is a question which is just repeated so often, and it never dies, because I don't know if it's just as simple as an economic question. And I think you realize that in your answer. It's about, you know, sort of like who we are as people. And I think some people wonder, like, what will human life be like when all of our labor is mechanized or digitized? And that's increasingly becoming common. Like, what will we do with our time? And I think my riposte to that kind of question would be that I think a lot of what makes us the most human is our ability to create and adapt and respond and learn. And that is sort of what we'll have to do with all of this. But I mean, there's no reason that can't be a fun process. It's a fun process for us on this show. Another thing I want to talk about, again, sort of in a similar vein, but on a much smaller scale, is evolution in another topic. The topic of our upcoming interview with Andreas Antonopoulos in this show, which is the evolution of Bitcoin and Bitcoin development. And one of the more interesting aspects and things to watch, because this is an open source technology and open source community, is the development process itself and the process of proposing changes. And those changes are commonly called Bitcoin Improvement Proposals, or BIPs, for listeners only 1 week less knowledgeable than me, because I'm just still figuring this stuff out. And there's actually recently another one BIP that's gotten a lot of attention. It's BIP 47. And I want to get your thoughts on this, Eric. This is an idea for reusable payment codes. And from my understanding of this, it's very analogous to basically, instead of using Bitcoin addresses and potentially revealing sort of information you may want to keep private, even with a public key, derived Bitcoin address. Sometimes you may want to keep your wallet addresses private. This is actually an alternative, which would be similar to putting your PGP public key fingerprint on a key server, and would allow basically peer-to-peer payments without that revelation of privacy, and it would actually be apparently a lot more data efficient than sort of the stealth addresses that Dark Wallet and some other solutions have proposed. But have you looked into this solution? And if not, what other BIPs are you looking at these days?
So this one is of particular interest to me because Bitcoin has never been anonymous. A lot of people very early on sort of advertised it as such. But the fact is, Bitcoin only currently works because you can trace every single Bitcoin in existence back through a chain of addresses or public keys until its original creation date. And that is very interesting to a number of, you know, state powers, centralized entities, financial analysis tools, to track people down and track the flow of money. If at any point in that chain, you identify where some publicly known identity, a real life identity, Eric Martindale, has published a Bitcoin address on his website, right? And this is both a positive and a negative. For me personally, I think it makes a lot of sense for me to publish a Bitcoin address so that the projects that I work on, anybody who wants to donate to them can go look at that Bitcoin address and literally see how much I've received. I think that's a very positive thing if used in that capacity. It's also a very compelling use case. We've talked about this before for charities. You know, when the brilliance of this transparency that Bitcoin offers, not anonymity, transparency, is that a charity can literally receive donations, and anyone in the world, including the donator, including the finalized recipient, including a financial auditing or rating organization for NGOs, can go in and look at exactly where the money went and say, oh, you know, you paid out 70% in salary to this person, and then only, you know, a very small fraction of the money actually went to the intended recipient. So that's a very good thing. But, for example, there can be a compelling argument for maintaining a sense of privacy as to how much money you know I'm receiving on a weekly basis or a monthly basis from my job. Salary transparency is a very, you know, scary thing. And as someone who it's a changing thing right now. There's some companies that want to publish that information publicly, which I agree with. But there's a lot of people out there who just are not okay with that idea, and they're looking for financial privacy. Imagine if, you know, I took all of my pay in Bitcoin for basically the past 2 years, and I plan to continue doing this. So BIP 47 is very interesting to me because it allows me to give away a fingerprint, a hash almost, that contains some data that lets me receive a payment from a peer, publish that key publicly, and receive a payment, but no one who can see that key can see how much was received. And it's a way of basically recovering those funds. And I think this very specifically is politically contentious. I don't think that the state powers that be that are trying to enforce laws and are trying to destroy personal privacy are going to be agreeable to this. But this does sort of interest me on the individual. I mean, not sort of, it very deeply interests me on the individual level, because it allows me to make the decision as to what records I want to be on the public worldwide ledger, and which records I want to simply be secured by the worldwide ledger without eliminating my personal privacy. This is perhaps the single biggest BIP. I mean, it's one of the older ones. By older, I mean it's BIP 47. We're at BIP 101 as of this week. It's been out there for a year or two, and it just recently has received a implementation that is being intended to be merged, actually, which is super exciting. And stealth addresses originally addressed this concern. They were too computationally complex, but this is the first real-world working scheme that doesn't have significant cost. And that dichotomy of choice is what is currently missing in Bitcoin. You have to, in order to use Bitcoin safely today, it is very difficult. You have to be very aware of what you're doing to maintain that privacy. Whereas with a BIP 47, we'll start to see the emergence of, I mean, if it actually gets accepted into Bitcoin Core, we'll see the emergence of tools that just come with automatic privacy, and you can make the choice individually instead of it being forced upon you by the existing code or by a state that, you know, forces you to expose records. And I think that's going to be a very long-term positive thing for crypto finance.
No, I love it. I love seeing, you know, a thousand flowers bloom, as they say. And I guess I've been sort of more of a conservative on core development insofar as I've had a personal policy on it in the past year or so. But I really do love seeing the flowering of choice, and that's kind of what the exciting thing about Bitcoin is, a different source project. It's exciting thing about things like sidechains, perhaps. And I can see a lot of really interesting uses for those. I mean, like going back to the 3D printing example, if you're, you know, doing manufacturing, or maybe you're maybe you're doing sort of Cody Wilson's thing. I'm not saying you should, but you want to be able to have some kind of anonymous payment, sort of a kind of an anonymous payment network that still has a public aspect. Sharing payment codes could be an interesting way to do that. And as it's just an option, it basically allows any number of use cases alongside the use cases that already exist. And, you know, we're all for choice. That's kind of the exciting thing about all this. And I definitely look forward to seeing how this is used and how people use it in ways that maybe can surprise us. Because it does seem like with all of these things, with 3D printing, with robots, with all of the ways people have adapted over years to, you know, how jobs, what careers look like in, you know, the midst of rapid innovation. It's always a surprise, and that's kind of the thing that keeps us excited and keeps us on our toes here.
Today we're joined by Andreas Antonopoulos, who's a renowned speaker and crypto financial evangelist, the author of Mastering Bitcoin, a co-host on Let's Talk Bitcoin, and the founder and CTO of Third Key Solutions. Andreas, thank you so much for joining us.
Eric, it's a pleasure. I'm really excited to be on the show.
Great. So a few years ago, you sort of became pretty popular. A lot of people listened to what you were saying. They would go to every talk you were doing. What do you think it is that draws people to what it is that you say about decentralized technology and Bitcoin in general?
Well, to tell you the truth, at first, I have no idea. I was as surprised as anybody else that happens. I've been a public speaker for more than 20 years now, so I see public speaking as a professional skill that I've worked to develop over a very long period of time, long before Bitcoin came along. And when I got involved in Bitcoin, you know, I realized that I'm a coder, but I'm not the best coder, and I'm not a professional full-time coder, and there are people who are much better at doing that. And so the skills that I could bring to bear on Bitcoin were primarily my public speaking and essentially words. That's my tool. So writing the book and doing public speaking were the way I thought I could best contribute to the community. And so I just started doing it. I didn't ask anybody. I just started showing up and doing interviews and calling journalists and things like that. And it snowballed from there. And I was just as surprised as everybody else that I reached the level of popularity that I did. I don't expect that necessarily to last. I wouldn't be surprised if I get replaced by someone else in the future. But as long as people want to keep listening and will come and see me talk, I'll keep going and I'll keep doing it.
Eric was observing earlier to me that you've been sort of less in the public eye of Bitcoin lately. And I don't know if that's true. You've been on Morgan Spurlock's show. You've been obviously promoting Mastering Bitcoin. But what kind of projects have been sort of taking up your time in the past few months and have been engaging you?
Yeah, I think I've been less in certain forums. So I spend less time on Reddit and exposing myself to the trolls there. But I can tell you that my media schedule hasn't slowed down. I'm doing a lot of community meetups. So I do a lot of Skype connections where I show up in recently Seoul, South Korea, Fargo, North Dakota, and various other places like that that have small communities for Bitcoin, and I'll go and speak there. And I'm still doing a lot of media work with more mainstream organizations and conferences. I've been working on a bunch of projects behind the scenes. Third Key Solutions was obviously one of the big projects I was involved in. So bringing multi-signature key generation storage recovery services and consulting to this industry and trying to develop the space for multi-signature, which I think is really important. I've been doing a lot more coding, still working on the book, had three print editions come out so far with various improvements and fixes, and I'm getting ready to start writing the second edition. Moving on that, I have another book in planning, in the planning stage. And just the same stuff day in, day out.
Can you go a little bit more into what you mentioned with multi-signature security and, you know, just explain it a little bit to any of our listeners who might not be involved and go into a little bit about Third Key Solutions and what that is all about?
Sure, absolutely. Well, multisig is one of those really incredible features that didn't even exist in the beginning. In Bitcoin, was introduced in 2012. It's a signature by it's a feature by which you can have a transaction pay into an address that's locked or controlled by multiple signatures. So that, for example, you have three signatories, and it takes at least two to approve spending from that specific address. Now, this technology is seemingly very simple, but what you can build with it is pretty astonishing. There's another technology that goes hand in hand with multi-signature, and that's hierarchical deterministic wallets, or deterministic wallets, which are basically wallets that allow you to start from a simple seed made of 12 or 24 words and then generate near infinite amounts of addresses from that. And if you combine the two, you create hierarchical deterministic multisig wallets, which basically allow you to have a near infinite amount of multi-signature addresses. Now, this technology is ideally suited for use in Bitcoin exchanges, in Bitcoin wallets, in hardware devices and things like that, where you want to give users control over keys, but at the same time have the ability to offer them various additional solutions. Like, for example, policy-based velocity controls. You can say, if you want to spend more than $1,000, we're going to send you a text message that you have to confirm, and that will protect from someone stealing from your wallet. So combined with this feature called oracles, where you have a third party acting as a signatory, you can add a lot of really interesting security features to wallets and put users in control. More importantly, that allows exchanges or wallet providers to not have custodial control over funds, which is a huge risk, both for external theft, but also creating kind of incentives for internal theft, embezzlement, etc. And so in many of these schemes, you'll have the user control one set of keys, and a provider might control a second set of keys, or use an oracle to provide velocity controls, as I mentioned before. And then usually the user will be asked to take a third key and store it somewhere securely. And the idea is that if ever the provider goes out of business, or the exchange goes out of business, or there's a problem, the user can independently, using the two keys, gain access to their funds no matter what happens to the provider. The problem with that model, of course, is that your average user, if you tell them, here's a third key, store it somewhere securely, that's not easy. It's in fact very difficult to do. A lot of the things that you would do to store a key securely will also make that key less likely to survive a natural disaster or a problem. Users find it very difficult to get this compromise between resilience, availability, and security in such a way that the key is secure, but at the same time it's available. Let me give you an example. I mean, what do most users do if you send them a PDF with a separate key to store securely? They take a screenshot and put it on their phone. They put it on their desktop under notmybitcoinstash.jpg. Don't look here. They print it out and store it somewhere, but then it's vulnerable to theft, fire, flood, loss. In extreme cases, someone who's sophisticated about this may make multiple copies and put one in a safe deposit box. But you know, most users are not that sophisticated. And if you're doing this for a company, it becomes really difficult to achieve solutions like that. So if you're a company and you're trying to do this, if you put your key in a safe deposit box, then who has access to that, under what conditions, et cetera, et cetera. Third Key Solutions is basically designed to solve these problems. First of all, to advise companies how to set up multi-signature schemes, but then to act as an independent signing agent that is jurisdictionally, organizationally independent from the provider or from the user, and be able to guarantee that those keys will be available, that they're stored securely, and that they will be available in the case of a loss or natural disaster to recover those keys. And by using a multi-signature scheme, we also don't have any control over the funds. So a single signature isn't enough to do anything. And that means that we can step in the case of an emergency, but we're not a point of vulnerability for the funds. And that's really the bulk of our business. We have a number of clients, more to be announced very soon, in fact. For example, Case Wallet, which is a hardware-based wallet with a built-in GSM 3G chip and a fingerprint reader, which allows you to spend Bitcoin. Well, each of those devices has a key within it. The provider of that software and hardware solution has a second key to provide policy controls. And Third Key Solution holds the third key so that even if the provider goes out of business, we can help individual users recover. Or if a user loses their hardware wallet, we, again, can help recover the funds. And this ensures that the provider doesn't hold both keys and therefore have custodial control. And we have that organizational independence to guarantee it.
So it's really interesting how just technically complex a lot of these subjects are. Yeah. For the average person in the world who may or may not even be aware of Bitcoin or let alone how asymmetric cryptography works, it becomes a very challenging topic to approach. Right. What is the compelling case for these types of technologies for someone who doesn't quite understand it yet? Why should they be interested in this stuff?
Well, we're not appealing to end users because quite honestly, end users, for the most part, are not sophisticated technically enough to use private keys, to control private keys, to store private keys securely, and to practice the operational security that's needed. So what we are seeing happen, and we think will continue to happen, is hiding those features, essentially, and making this operate behind the scenes. So now the question is, there are two ways to do that. One is to take the responsibility and control completely away from the user and essentially take custody of their funds. We have a word for that. It's called banking, and it leads to banking failures like Gox. And so the problem with custodial control over funds is that it violates the fundamental principles of Bitcoin. It exposes users to other risks, counterparty risks, that they didn't have before. And so what we're really looking at is this solution where you can both have the user in control, have no other organization have majority control over their funds or custodial control over the funds, but at the same time be able to hide the presence of the key, to make it invisible to the user, and give them a level of security behind the scenes that they don't really need to understand how it works. For the same reason that most users don't understand how SSL works, most users don't even know what SSL is. But as long as that little padlock turns on and more websites do it, that delivers a level of guarantee. Now, if you understand how that system works, behind the scenes, there's certificate authorities that do various background checks and have processes for expiry and revocation of certificates, et cetera, et cetera. We're doing something very similar in the multi-sig space on the basis of a new technology. But from the perspective of the end user, this is invisible. A user who uses a Case hardware wallet, for example, their primary authenticator is a fingerprint. And beyond that, they don't even know that their device has one key or that their provider doesn't have two more keys and therefore able to take their money away. But the sophisticated users who ask that really important question, why should I trust you and what can you do with the remaining keys, the idea of having an independent third party control the third key is really important because it provides for this type of decentralized control, which is the essence of Bitcoin.
So Andreas, in much of your work outside of Third Key Solutions, you're kind of addressing a different audience, sort of the average person who may be slightly more interested in sort of topics around maybe privacy or maybe economics, finance. How do you balance in your work life your evangelism with your building, basically, with building Third Key Solutions, with working on these kind of more expert specialist fields?
Well, I mean, it's the same as the difference between the book that I wrote, Mastering Bitcoin, which is not really designed to be read by a mainstream audience. You can probably wade through the first two chapters if you're not technical. But beyond that, it's written for programmers. It's for software developers. And it's published by a technical publisher, O'Reilly Media. It's under an open source license. You can find it online. All of those things have nothing to do with a mainstream audience. I try to keep the work that I do in terms of media and evangelism very separate from either the book or the work I'm doing for Third Key Solutions or any other work I'm doing behind the scenes in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies and the advice I give other clients. So when I go and speak to in public to mainstream audiences, I don't use the opportunity to promote my book or use the opportunity to, you know, shill for any of my clients or Third Key Solutions or anything like that. I think it's important to keep that barrier. I go to basically convey my passion and enthusiasm for Bitcoin as a technology to people who've never heard it before. And, you know, if the skill I can bring to bear for Bitcoin is being able to take a technical topic, understand it well, but then be able to explain it in very simple terms, then I'll keep doing that.
Actually, we have a couple questions here from the audience that came through, so I wanted to go to one of those. And this one is from John Ratcliffe. I'm going to actually quote exactly what he said. He said, "Do you believe the scalability of Bitcoin will happen through off-chain solutions? And if so, do you believe these off-chain solutions must also be decentralized, peer-to-peer, and with the same features of and protections of Bitcoin itself?"
Well, that's a loaded question in this particular environment. With, you know, there's for those who are not familiar, there's a massive debate going on at the moment in terms of how scalability can be achieved in Bitcoin, and the participants in this debate have split into two camps that are in many cases being quite nasty to each other. But, you know, we've got small blockists and big blockists, and each side will tell you that unless something is done urgently, the other side will destroy Bitcoin. So nothing less than the stake of the future of the world is at stake here, which I find hyperbolic, to say the least. From an engineering perspective, Bitcoin scalability, as with any other software system and protocol, is a matter of incremental change. It won't happen with one thing. It will happen with many things at the same time. And very few problems are fundamentally intractable or unsolvable. I don't think Bitcoin has any design flaws, if you like, that make any of the scalability problems intractable. So the answer is Bitcoin scalability will be addressed simultaneously by potentially changes in the block size limit through a hard fork in the near future, through off-channel and off-chain payment solutions, be that point-to-point payment channels or point-to-multi-point payment channels through Lightning Network, side chains, off-chain transactions as Coinbase or ChangeTip do, and a myriad of other solutions that we have barely imagined. It's both too early to worry about those things and really too early in the maturity of the technology to see what solutions will come out. I think we do have a scalability issue coming simply because if Bitcoin continues to exist, it is successful. So Bitcoin's success is simply continuance, survival. Every year that goes by that Bitcoin exists, it doubles its projected lifetime. So if you take, this is Lewis Law, if you take a six-year-old cryptocurrency, the fact that it has existed for 6 years means that there is a very high probability that it will exist for at least six more. And every year that goes by and Bitcoin survives, its lifetime becomes longer and longer. It becomes more firmly established. Secondary benefits like the permanence of the record become even more valuable as more time is piled on. And all of these things feed into each other. And so we do need to change some of the scalability issues or address some of the scalability issues now. And part of the reason for that is because if there is a sudden influx of new users or a sudden influx of capital with people buying Bitcoin, and the scalability isn't there, that's going to lead to some capacity problems, which may cause a hiccup in adoption. I think you never know when these events will happen, and you never know when they're going to come or where they're going to come from. But we're seeing, for example, in China, 4 million people opening brokerage accounts per week. With numbers like that, all it takes is a single little rumor that Bitcoin is about to do something interesting or that Bitcoin is something that people should invest in, and you could see an influx of cash into Bitcoin from China. The quite honestly, we can't sustain. And I think that's pretty much what happened in November 2013. Now, keep in mind, I don't think that's a good thing. I don't think adoption by speculators looking for get-rich-quick schemes is, and suddenly flooding money into Bitcoin is a good thing. I think it destabilizes Bitcoin. But nevertheless, it may happen. You can't stop it from happening, and it may happen unexpectedly. So long story short, there is no one solution to scalability. Scalability is something that will be addressed in many, many different ways, structurally, architecturally, in the protocol, in additional protocol layers above the protocol, in sidechains. All of the above will be required to scale Bitcoin over the next 20 years, and I think we'll see a lot of different solutions emerge.
So you mentioned China, and that raises another very interesting discussion point surrounding the scalability question. One of our guests, one of our listeners, Evander Smart, has asked, you know, what's your sort of assessment around the centralization that might be might happen as a result of a block size increase towards the China mining and exchange groups?
I don't think that centralization is a necessarily predictable outcome of a block size increase. It may reduce the profitability of some of the mining centers in China, but they already have a compelling advantage because of inexpensive electricity and low regulation over inexpensive electricity, which means that creates an enormous subsidy. So if that was balanced by effectively a negative effect on bandwidth because of the low bandwidth and high latency that you see on links in China, that would arguably also enable the rest of the world to be as profitable as the Chinese have been. So what we've seen right now is a centralization of mining in China because of electricity subsidies. And arguably, if there is the opposite effect because of bandwidth, you may see decentralization and a greater part being played by, for example, geothermal hydroelectric in Canada and Iceland and other places like that, and the leveling of the playing field. And you can't really predict these things, but I think the centralization bogeyman, because it's such a strong principle that so many people in Bitcoin are really passionate about, becomes the crux of this debate, and each side will accuse the other of being evil centralizers, which is really not an engineering argument. It's a prediction, and a prediction that you really can't model because there is a lot more variables you can't control in such a thing. So I think we let the market, I think we let the dynamic difficulty adjustment and mining algorithm play out, because so far what I've seen is that Bitcoin is far more resilient than people think, and that concerns about centralization and 51% attacks and centralization of mining pools that we had last year, everybody was freaking out over GHash.io. GHash now has 3% of the hash rate. So a lot of these fears end up being played up, and then in hindsight we see that it wasn't such a big deal, that the network adapted, that the markets adapted, and so what everybody was worrying about came and went with no big deal. I don't see why that would change. I am much more trusting in Bitcoin's dynamic ability to adjust and the self-interest of all of the people who are invested in hardware and software and startups and in all of the ecosystem around Bitcoin to protect it from these adverse effects.
It's a great irony of this, and something we really enjoy kind of digging into is a spontaneous order that seems to emerge even in a decentralized network like this, or a distributed one. But while we're on the topic of Bitcoin development, we wanted to ask you, are there any Bitcoin improvement proposals, or BITs as they're called, out there now which are exciting your interest or which you feel have some particular merit for the future of Bitcoin's development?
Okay. There's a lot. I think
true.
It takes about a year to a year and a half before you see something going from a BIP to wide-scale deployment. So I think the industry is really now coalescing around BIP32, which is the hierarchical deterministic wallet, and around multisig. I mean, those two technologies are really 2012 technologies, and it took almost 3 years to see them start to appear in the majority of new wallets that are being created and starting to see support infrastructure and companies coalesce around that. So what other things are looming in the background? BIP 43, 44, 45, which are various hierarchical deterministic path structures for doing multi-sig and doing various purpose-specific and multi-currency things. I think those are very interesting. We've seen a lot of people experiment with them. I think we're beginning to see products come out that that take advantage of that. For the future, I'm very excited by payment channels. And I don't think there's actually been a BIP for the payment channel implementation that we see in Bitcoin J. And yet it's been implemented primarily because it's not a new standard per se. It's really more an implementation artifact of two existing technologies, which are multisig and lock time. So what's coming in the pipeline? Check lock time verify and relative check lock time verify based on input sequence numbers, I think is really, really exciting technology, being able to do per input lock times. This basically to explain to a more mainstream audience, what this allows you to do is to post-date a Bitcoin transaction. So if you post-date a Bitcoin transaction, it's like post-dating a check, but the difference is that this is based on a consensus rule that is inviolable in the network, which means that you are guaranteed that no one can cash this transaction before the post-date. These new technologies allow you to do some very interesting things, such as collecting inputs from various parts of the transaction and dating them differently, or allowing the sequencing of transactions where the post-dating happens as a relative time to the inputs that are coming in. What this can do is it can take payment channels to the next level. It can enable a number of different second order features to emerge because you have this flexibility. It's something I'm going to be talking about in my upcoming appearance in London, which is this idea that these trust primitives that we have, multisig and lock time, transaction verification, 10-minute block time, all the heartbeat of Bitcoin, all of these things are essentially trust primitives that are guaranteed by the consensus rules. They form a language. With that language, you can now form sentences, almost like an algebra, by combining the basic operators. And payment channels are a great example of combining multisig and lock time to create something completely new, a micropayment system. But we haven't finished, because the magic thing about an algebra or a language that has syntax is that if you have the basic building blocks, operators, or if you want in a language case, verbs and nouns, the number of sentences you can create is infinite. And so innovation in Bitcoin is happening at two levels. On the one hand, we're inventing new verbs and nouns. On the other hand, we're then finding new ways to recombine the existing verbs and nouns into exciting new sentences. That's some of the things. I think the other interesting BIP for me is the bitwise block version BIP, which basically means that the block version number is no longer simply an incrementing integer. We've gone from block version 2 to block version 3. But instead, it's a bit field, which would allow for the deployment of multiple soft fork and possibly even hard fork features in parallel with voting thresholds and activation thresholds for miners. So if you've been following the block size debate, that's actually one of the things that ended up getting implemented in Gavin's proposal, even though it was a very new thing and could play a role in the block size increase, which is assigning specific bits within the block version to activate and gather consensus around that change. That's going to be really useful because it allows for more complex phased incremental changes. One of the things I've been concerned about in Bitcoin and I've talked about in the past is that as the protocol gets embedded in hardware and gets embedded in more and more devices that run unattended and don't take upgrades very easily, this leads to ossification. We're beginning to see already that it's getting harder and harder to push changes through to the core protocol. Imagine what happens if, say, 21E6 is successful and a million toasters are running nodes. and none of those can be upgraded because they don't have a network connection. You're basically locking in Bitcoin versions, and that means that gradually the innovation is going to have to move to the layers above. So the BIP that allows for bit sequencing of block versions actually could offer some interesting solutions there. Let's see. Proof of payment is another BIP that I think is fascinating. Proof of payment allows you essentially to create a mock transaction that proves that you can pay in the future but have not, but is not valid as a transaction itself. It's a commitment to a future payment that can have a rigorous proof to it and can be subject to the consensus rules that you can independently verify and validate. That is really interesting because that means that without escrowing money, without committing money to a post-dated transaction, you can effectively prove that you have the funds under your control, which could be used for a future escrow or something like that. And again, I look at each one of these things as a trust primitive that could be recombined into more complex features and capabilities by all of the incredible innovating companies out there in the ecosystem.
Well, Andreas, our time is pretty much almost up. We just wanted to give you a chance to plug all of your projects that you'd like to, including Mastering Bitcoin, which we didn't even have a chance to go into. You know, tell us a little bit about, you know, what you're doing there and how, you know, your real position as probably the most notable person in the Bitcoin space has really helped, you know, the book and all these other projects you're with.
Well, the book was really a very simple idea. If you accept the premise that Bitcoin is a powerful technology that has real utility and can change people's lives, then the next and most important question is, how do you get that knowledge into as many brains as possible, as quickly as possible? And if you also accept that this is a matter that will very seriously affect and impact developing nations, then you want to get this education and information out to as many people as possible. When I was looking to learn about Bitcoin, of course, I found that the information was scattered in many different sources, but there wasn't one definitive guide that covered all of the basic insides or intricate details of how Bitcoin works in a single book. Of course, that's slightly audacious to claim, and that book is both never complete and never correct. But it is a start, and There's two things I wanted to emphasize about the book. First of all, you can go out and buy it, and that would be great, fantastic. I like getting paid for my work occasionally. I do most of it for free. But if you buy it, thank you so much. I really appreciate the contribution. It was quite a lot of work. But honestly, if you know anything about publishing, I'm never going to really make much more than minimum wage on that. The book is also, and this is really important, is also available under an open source license. And this has two effects. First of all, it's licensed under Creative Commons CC BY SA. O'Reilly is the kind of publisher that is very open to open source, and they were very happy to change the license to an attribution share-like license once the book showed that it could sell. And what that means is two things. One, you can go on GitHub, you can download the book, and you can read it for free. And that's really important because there's a lot of developers around the world who simply can't afford a $34 book or a $25 ebook in order to learn about a new technology. And so the ability to make sure that that information is available for free was really important. But the second thing that's even more exciting about that is that this license allows for derivatives and transformative work based on the book, meaning that if you want to use it for a course curriculum as a textbook in a postgraduate or graduate degree, something to base an online course or to use materials for some kind of tutorial or MOOC, then you can go ahead and do it. And more importantly, you can also change the language. So I would like to draw attention to the fact that Mastering Bitcoin is on TransFX, which is a translation crowdsourcing platform. And thanks to the efforts of 125 or so volunteers, it has now been fully translated into Hungarian. The Japanese, French, and Spanish translations are more than 90% complete. And there are 28 other languages in progress. This book is getting translated into Arabic, Mandarin, Turkish, Greek, Italian, Spanish, German, French, Thai, Vietnamese, Korean, and I'm probably forgetting half a dozen other languages. It's really exciting, and this is entirely a volunteer effort. Most importantly, this can be republished by any publisher in the world in any of these languages under the terms of the license, so they can commercially promote it, sell it, sell paper copies. But each one of those versions, translated versions, is also free to read, free to share, and will always be open source. So if you're interested in that effort, I would love to get more volunteers to contribute to that effort and translate it as many languages as possible. If you think of Bitcoin as a meme, then if you think of Bitcoin as a meme that's revolutionary, this is the Software Guerrilla Handbook, and we need to get it into as many young minds as possible, in as many countries as possible, in as many languages as possible, in order to put some real grassroots volume behind this effort.
We totally agree, and that's the reason we started the Decentralized Show. So, yes. First of all, thank you again for joining us, but we have one final question.
Please.
What is it about decentralization that it is that matters to the average person in the rest of the world?
It's simple. One word, justice. You can't have justice with an imbalance of power. You can't have justice when you're powerless. And, you know, to me that's really important because it ties into another topic that I'm very passionate about, which is peace. And peace is not the absence of war, it's the presence of justice. And so therefore, decentralization, the diffusion of power to as many people as possible, avoiding the concentration of power that leads to corruption, leads directly to a more peaceful world, a more just world. And I think that network-based technologies are one of the things that have happened this century that really offer tangible results for peace and justice around the world. And Bitcoin is one of them.
As always, Andreas, a very enlightening and inspiring conversation. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for your time, guys. Thank you for having me on the show, and I look forward to doing this again.
Absolutely. We'll have you on again for sure.
Decentralized was edited and produced by Chaz Ferguson. Music written and performed by Tony Lees. You can download past episodes at decentralized.fm or on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/decentralized-podcast. And follow us on Twitter at @decentralizeall.